Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Dan's Leon.
Fire. Lawyer Dan, stop lawyering.
But Mackie, how can Lawyer Dan stop lawyering when Dan is a lawyer?
Hi, and welcome to episode 254. I'm today's guest host, Fire Makalua.
I have pizza and you don't.
Angelon.
Or Arvius on Twitch.
Thank you.
I've taken Mackie's coffee when she wasn't looking.
And the me and team.
As usual, bringing TMI tea to your strategies.
Haha, joke's on Dan. I don't have coffee this morning.
That's right, because I took it from you when you weren't looking.
I didn't have it to start with.
TMI. Ha ha. Oh, wait. That's later. I mean,
No, that's during... Well, never mind. I didn't know about that.
Yes, I roped Mackie into it. Yes. We get to talk about our recent gameplay experiences. The most important thing to remember is always greet Sam, for sure. But I don't actually play in his games a whole lot because I'm usually one of the hosts of the other games, so I only get to greet Dan here and there, but I do my best to encourage it in others.
So griefing is like when you're about to have your coastal capital capture and you just have triremes in the water just waiting to fillage all the fishing boats. That kind of griefing?
Well, it's more along the lines of people trying to city snipe or, for example, bribing Shaka to declare war on Dan. That kind of thing.
I see.
Not that the latter ever happened or anything.
Not that it was part of a Polycast special at some point or anything.
No, of course not. Although that one wasn't me doing it. Yeah, more recently, well, last week, I kind of got internet issues, and that didn't help. So I don't have a lot of good stories personally from recent.
Well, as far as recent gameplay experiences, I'm playing a marathon game at Spain at the moment. And because it was marathon, I moved around and stumbled upon Kilimanjaro for my capital. But later on, something interesting that happened was I found Uru on the other side of the continent. And this is a Terra game, so all aces are on this continent. And at first I was disappointed because I was so far away from Uluru. But then we got to the Renaissance era and nobody had settled Uluru yet. So I sent a settler all the way across the continent. And now I've got two cities on the opposite side of the map, one next to Uluru, which is kind of inconceivable to me that the AI has never settled it because there were two capitals that are right next to it. And no one took it all the way into the Renaissance era.
All right, two things. Number one, Renaissance!
Ow.
Number two, you started off by saying that you are playing Spain, and then you start talking about all these natural wonders that you found. So, all right, here we go. Brag, 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 na 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 na. So you see, even if you don't settle for it, you've already won, because you got the money for it.
That's true. But in Marathon, the money isn't as much. She'll only get 500 gold.
That's true. It does not scale with game speed, no. It's not.
Yeah, it's
a little by a settler, right?
Yeah, but it's not, like, going to carry you as much through the early game.
You need to find three wonders in the early game in order to buy a settler.
Oh, jeez.
Although, it's still nice. Marathon really lets you just completely wreck any AI that you can reach, which on a Terra would be all of them.
It's true.
So it's sounding like the AI was not valuing... Well, in addition to the natural wonder, it's not valuing the terrain around it. So is it just that if it settled for that natural wonder, it would quote-unquote only be able to get that natural wonder? It wouldn't give it like a strategic or a luxury resource it didn't already have? Because I find that it prioritizes those things more, even though, hey, great, you got that six iron, enjoy all that ice and tundra that you can't grow the city, and you didn't even settle on the resource. You're going to be able to work that tile? Good grief, AI. I mean, I understand why you weren't settling for the one there, because it was on the other side of the continent from you, where the AIs were.
Yeah, pretty much. The Ottomans spammed about six cities, but in the opposite direction. Byzantium was the other civ that was right next to Uluru, and she only built three cities, one of which was also on the other side of the continent from her. So it was a little bit puzzling as to how Uluru was still available in the late Renaissance. It might have even been early industrial era.
We're going to have a talk with the Civ 6 developers on that one.
No, no, you see, I think what the AI is saying, Ray, is that they don't feel the need to settle for these natural resources in order to improve their standing in the game because they don't see you as real competition, so you should go wipe them out.
Well, that was my plan in any case, but I actually am tired of domination victory, so I wanted to win a culture victory in this game instead, which I think I'm well on the way towards.
You have adopted aesthetics, right?
I think I'm one policy from completing it in the late industrial. No, mid-industrial era.
Raising gameplay. Well, mine's going to be far different because of the mods that I've been using made by Fruit Strike, which changes like social policies and units and positions of certain things such as infantry in the tech tree. It's not tied to plastics, for example. That's a pretty big game changer.
It is important to change positions.
I also only play multiplayer, and then there's the Hellblazer map script, which messes with the map in a pretty big way.
I mean, okay, yes, cooperative multiplayer can also be competitive, but for strict delineation purposes, it's competitive multiplayer, right? Like you are trying to beat fellow human players. There may or may not be AI at all, maybe not even city-states. You're trying to...
No AIs.
Yeah, okay, so you're trying to kill the other player, right? That's usually the victory condition that...
Well, there are city-states, there are diplomatic victory, there's cultural victory too, but there's just no AIs.
I would imagine it would be pretty tough to win Diplo in most games, unless the roles have changed really substantially.
Depends how the game develops.
Oh, okay. I mean, I guess, like, you can win Diplo or Culture if you beat everyone down to the point where they can't resist you and then buy out city-states or, like, you throw your charge on them when they're down to one city. But I mean, like, for practical purposes where the game is otherwise still contested.
They can't buy your city-states if you war deck them.
Well, yeah. But they're not going to do that if you knock them down to one city and they peaced out so they didn't die. That's what I'm saying, like, unless you have the stuff to stop it. But at that point,
that's one of the biggest problems. Them killing off your city-states.
Yeah.
My impression was that multiplayer games pretty much always finished either science or domination.
Yeah, but he's running mods, so that might not be the case.
True.
I would say in terms of recent gameplay experiences, nothing specific, but it's always kind of one of those balances. And most of the games that I've played of late are multiplayer, if only to get me out of my rut of setting up particular settings, like a particular map type, like, oh, let's go desert and Byzantium, or let's go highlands and Inca, because the people that I would play with would either be like, what color Inca do you want to be, or no, Dan. So it's always kind of a balance in multiplayer when you're thinking about quote-unquote winning the game by having the high score. It's kind of the balance, like, I want to take out my AI early so that, okay, you know, I've quote-unquote done my job, but then I have to try to grow the cities larger for pop for greater score and construct the wonders and not get the AI dirt bonuses. So if I let them sit there and grow a little larger, build a few more wonders, maybe settle a few more cities and get more territory, and then increase their score, then there's that kind of line between, am I going to be farther ahead in the end by waiting till closer to the end to take them and then have this huge score jump?
The answer is, unfortunately, yes. And that's why I don't tend to get high score that frequently, because it's annoying. But you can just sit there on tradition, spam out as many wonders and found your own religion as possible, and then whenever your AI near you builds the wonders, be like, yeah, I'll take those wonders now too, and oh look, now I'm high score. I'm so good. Yeah, that's not my preferred play style, so I don't do it, but if you want the most points, there you go.
I think what you end up having to do, if you don't do that, you take out your AI early, then I often find it becomes an economic management simulation for me in the sense of, okay, I'm balancing the gold, I'm balancing the science, I'm balancing the happy, and I need to expand, and I need to grow.
You just expanded. What are you talking about? You just need to get happiness and grow.
Well, exactly. Get happiness and grow. So between, well, first off, maritime for growing for the food, and then mercantile for the happy, and then maybe perhaps settling some city spots that I wouldn't normally otherwise, either in the game because I would still be trying to take out my AI, or if it was single player, it's not really necessarily ideal to place this city, but I'm not looking to fight anymore, so I'm just trying to fill in the map to increase my score, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people notice and they're like, Dan, are you settling like a whole bunch of cities to increase your score?
No.
I'm just trying not to be bored and hit end turn while you do what you were supposed to do 30 turns ago.
The problem is I feel like it's easier, unless your city's already freaking huge, to grow your city as opposed to settling a new one, because that takes away several happiness instead of just one from raising a pop.
Yeah, well, yeah, it depends on your land. I mean, how much more are you going to be able to grow that city? Plus, I also take into account how close are the other humans to taking up their AI. Mm. Am I actually going to be better off waiting for this city to grow, or it'd just be better to, like, spam out a whole bunch of settlers and go plonk, 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 plonk? Not that I've ever done that before. No, never.
Yeah, you just wait until someone says, hey, I'm three turns out, and then all of a sudden you found, like, 10 cities that turn. Okay.
I just thought about it this turn, guys. Honest.
Yeah.
I didn't pre-plan to move the settlers into nice spaces and have them guarded or anything. Nope.
It looks like you've actually become more of a player like me. I'm proud.
Uh-oh.
I approve, Dan.
Dan's going to take a moment because your approval fills him with shame.
No, mission accomplished. But it's true. I mean, that strat is pretty much the same type of thing as my farming over the cottages. Sorry, it's just the fact of the matter. You can't really do anything about it. You have become more alike than me and Tegan. Congratulations.
I'm just going to go with I've become less like myself.
Right. Okay.
Well, that's also true insofar as that you and I were not previously identical, but you are getting closer to me. Aww.
Reddit. Trying to read this name. Raskar 26. The princess Malamet. Anyway, he wanted to talk about the long-lasting unit. He said, what would you say is the most durable unit in the game, i.e. the one that is in some way useful for the longest time? Well, workers. just to start you there. But I think he means military units. Because he said he would probably say the crossbow, because it starts in the medieval era. It's still fairly common in the modern era. What are you playing, man? I have seen it still have a role to start.
For happiness if you ran on her.
Yeah, but also I've seen it still have a role at the start of the atomic era.
Well, this tells me that perhaps he needs to increase his difficulty level. If when he's in that era, the AI is far enough behind that the crossbow is still effective.
He's saying it's not a frontline unit. He's using it to, like, wear things down from range or pick off a rifleman or something while your modern units do things. But
like, stops doing damage eventually. I have used them into the early to mid-industrial if I happen to get them to the point where they have range and logistics. Because at that point, you might as well bring them along. They can shoot enemy units from areas that your other units can't, except for artillery with setup time. So they have some use there to double-shot enemies from really far away. Fine. It's not a lot of damage, but it's some damage. You might as well use it. But even so,
I think my use for them in that era would be just to keep them at home for defense, at where I could upgrade them if the defense was actually necessary, but I probably haven't bothered to upgrade them until I actually get attacked.
I think I might have them at home if I have adopted oligarchy under tradition, because then, I mean, they're not costing any maintenance, but I might also be using them for happiness purposes as well, but... Yeah, like Ray, if then that city then became threatened, then I could turn around and upgrade them.
And the Gatling guns? I would much rather have Artie in a city than a Gatling gun, unless the Gatling gun is just, like, uber-promoted, but then I'd rather use it, like, offensively.
Well, that's kind of incidental. It's like, okay, well, I have this unit, it's stationed in the city, okay, it's not costing me any maintenance, I don't really want it on the front line anymore, I'm not so concerned about, oh, if I delete this unit... Or just, you know, like, upgrade it and have it, you know, become cannon fodder, then I release that gold. But, yeah, it would be pretty rare that I would have a crossbowman sitting around in modern era, let alone atomic. But, you know, anyway.
Some city on the back front line maybe was plonking at barbs for a really long time, but I'd be surprised to find that many.
Oh, I know. I know what could happen. You intended to set wait until healed.
Oh, and you said 4 to 5? 10,000 years later.
Well, we're quibbling with the length of time that he says, but I think he has a point in that the crossbow is probably one of the longer-lasting mainstream military units.
If you don't count the upgrade path, I would agree. It probably has the biggest usage window without factoring upgrades.
Well, are we considering special units? Because the Camel Archer is clearly the number one here.
So that's why I said of the mainstream units. What I meant was non-unique by mainstream.
He did also highlight knights are still good for pillaging, you know, which is true. It doesn't matter. A fast unit that can run in and pillage the crap out of everything is still good, even if it's probably going to get shot off by the city, but hey.
Of the unique units, I think the Assyrian siege tower is probably the one that I use most after it should be outdated, just for the sapper bonus.
I agree with Ray. Of all the unique units, and I also agree that in terms of mainline unit would be crossbowmen, but definitely the Assyrian siege tower replacing the catapult. I know, and it came up in the thread, someone said, well, what about the Hunnic battering ram? Okay, it's true that the battering ram does come at the ancient era instead of classical, and there is nothing quite like being the Huns and moving a
carpet of battering ram doom.
Wander into a camp, instead of becoming a spearman, become a battering ram. That's great, but seeing as how the battering ram has a 33% increased cost, it's got a negative on defense, and as Ray was saying, the sapper promotion, it carries over, and sapper promotion when you're next to an enemy city, other units within two tiles get a 50% bonus when attacking the city, which includes other siege towers, which includes when it's embarked. Oh, and the Assyrian siege tower, unlike the battering ram, also gets extra sight. So it really has, I would say, almost way too much use, especially when it's a unique unit. Like, to me, it's kind of like a subset of this conversation. It would be nice to see that a mainline unit actually be the longest-lasting unit, mainline combat unit, because, yes, I agree with Mackie. If we're talking about long-lasting units, yes, workers. But in terms of combat, I really wish the answer was a mainstream unit, because a unique unit should not be the longest lasting. It should be specialized for a particular era when it is stronger than others. And yeah, okay, maybe it then carries over into another era after that due to its combat experience and promotions that you get. But man, it is hard to compete with the Assyrian siege tower, although I would say the closest to that would be the Ship of the Line from England. But seeing as how most of the combat in most games is going to be on land, then I would say Assyrian Siege Tower, plus the fact that it's available in the freaking classical, as opposed to having to wait until Renaissance for the Ship of the Line, that gives it the edge.
Horse Archer wins.
Wins what?
Life. Civ.
Well, if it may well win life, but it's not going to win this title of longest lasting unit for durability. It's 5.
Well, it's available in a very early era, and it stops being good when exactly?
Probably
cavalry.
Medieval.
Cavalry and lancers will crush them.
Yeah, mid-Renaissance is when it stops being effective. But that's a long
time. Camel archers, those are good until bombers.
Yeah, but you don't get them until medieval.
They last until Great War bombers. That's crazy.
I'm not sure. It's actually a longer period of time on the tech tree, though.
Just remember that the Assyrian siege tower gives a 50% bonus to other units within two tiles when attacking a city, regardless of subsequent era. I don't know how you can beat that for the sapper promotion alone. If there wasn't the sapper promotion, this might be a more interesting conversation. But I'm dropping the mic, like, boom, siege tower.
Hmm.
The embarkation is what makes it last a really long time, because at some point the defense is going to be that it gets killed too easily. But since you can embark it and protect it with a ship, use that trick, its usefulness is pretty much forever.
No way. Once you get the nukes, it stops mattering.
Okay, Grim.
And on the siege towers, in addition to being protected by ships at sea, as Ray was saying, another nice thing about it is that even on land, you can have it so that whatever unit is either bombarding the city or it's another melee unit attacking the city, you can have it so that the siege tower is out of bombard range of the city and whatever units are in there as well, to give it added protection even on land, because, of course, you can't stack one land unit on top of another land unit. Well, and end your turn anyway.
But the cyber bonus doesn't work unless it's against the city.
I still say Assyrian siege tower, but Impies might be my number two just because of their anti-gunpowder bonus.
They're okay, but their upgrade path makes them really a tough sell.
Well, I know for a lot of people their Troll Dan ability is high, but why is that the first thing I thought of when Impies were said? And it wasn't Troll said it.
Weird.
Impy would also be very strong because not only what it replaces, but its ability to carry over into the next era, even if it hasn't had any combat experience, and I don't know why you would construct them and not have that experience, but that ability for that strength plus the unique ability that they can have.
They get like a small attack before they do their real attack, basically.
Yeah, that's it.
But
yeah.
Their ability to get three moves is what makes them more enticing in my mind.
True.
The other Buffalo promotions are pretty good too, but the three move is really nice on something that does not share cavalry's weaknesses and has that attack in addition.
The mounted moves without the combat penalty against cities.
Yeah, or the weaknesses for that matter.
Religion, right? We're talking about spreading religion?
Yeah.
Or on issues, preventing themselves.
Yeah, preventing the spread of from others.
Yeah. Mm. Well, there's pretty much only one thing you can do there, in my mind, is blocking your city with workers and units and stuff like that so they can't actually burn on your city. But I'd say the better preventative course is to actually get your own religion out there.
Yeah, I really thought you were going to say declare war. I really, really did.
Well, that is the most obvious, but in this case, the Rover 6695 is saying, you know, he's friends with an AI, and he presumably wants to keep that status going. And as others have pointed out in the thread, if you station an Inquisitor either adjacent to or in a city, the AI will not use a missionary there.
Which is actually a smart move on the AI's part.
I guess. I mean, if you just want to be annoying, you can overwhelm Inquisitor.
You can also just make a line of units if they can't go through your units.
Yeah, you can, but that's more costly and annoying to pay the maintenance on that. Or.
Well, if you have them anyways.
Yeah, if you do, yes, it's an option.
Yeah, having the Inquisitor there, I just kind of view it as, you know, someone's looking to steal a car in the parking lot, and there's a car that's locked and there's a car that's not. Sure, you can go to the effort of the car that's got the lock and the stay case here of the missionary, but it's just easier to get in the car that's not locked and drive away. So you go for an easier target, a softer target to spread your religion.
Yeah.
So in that respect, you can actually take that advice and flip it around. It's like, oh, you want to spread your religion to someone else, whether it's a human or AI? Inquisitor's around. Maybe go somewhere else.
Well, if it's just a missionary, there's another defense you could have instead of Inquisitors, is just leave your city at one population, and after 12 turns, it will convert, and then that's just going to spread all around the map, potentially. So you don't even have to worry about anything until you see a great prophet running your way.
Yeah, but I'd rather not leave my city at... I mean, in an extreme situation, I mean, to troll another person to be like, nanner, 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 yeah, absolutely, but that would be more tactical than strategic.
Well, the best troll thing you can do is to, like, game the spread, right? Like, you buy an early missionary or two if you really want to put fire on the continent, and then you kind of work it like the ore fields in Command and Conquer. You send that missionary far enough out that it can double pressure a lot of cities in between and also exert pressure even further up. And then you do, like, one more that gets even more double pressure on the in-between, and then you just get so much auto-spread across the whole frickin' continent. It's usually not worth delaying your reform, but if you really want that religion everywhere, it will do it.
And I guess another thing with that, if it's missionary spam as opposed to great prophet spam, of course, if you don't have open borders with that person, then the effectiveness of every turn that missionary stays in your territory is lessened. So combining something that Chris said before, you could have it so that you have...
Trap it, yeah.
Yeah, stationed units such that it's going to have to go a long way around in order to get to a city, and by the time it actually gets there, its effect of being able to spread the religion is, if not inconsequential, then to the point that even if it does convert it, it's only for a very short period of time, or even better off, not converting it at all, and then giving you time to apply your own pressure.
On a related note, sometimes when I don't have enough units to completely block a missionary, what I'll do is I'll just use the units that I have to block the roads. And that way, it has to expend more turns in my territory going around the roads, and it'll eventually just die of that thing that causes them to die attrition. From being in your territory. Yeah, attrition.
Yeah, that works too. And I know he's friends with this AI, but there's nothing more than saying, you know, with friends like that, who needs enemies? Especially if you've told them to stop. Because he said, I told them to stop spreading the religion, and they didn't. I've noticed the AI sometimes that will full stop, but often it's just, okay, we'll stop spreading for now.
Until my next missionary gets there.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to maintain that friendship status, if it's just give me a few extra turns because I know the trade route that I've got with you is coming up for renewal, I can see that you're really pushing this religion hard because of the units I see on the map and the other places that you're going, but I really don't want to feel like I have to declare war on you to stop this, so just give me a few more turns, allow me to reroute the trade route or move these units in position or whatever, just even if it's just kind of delaying the inevitable, that is also helpful. But of course, if you tell them to not... And then they're like, screw you, then, well, hopefully you've already kind of anticipated them actually being upfront with you. I mean, they're supposed to be your friends after all, and be honest with you and say, like, actually, no, we're going to continue spreading it. Plan B. Hopefully Plan B is already engaged. When I'm looking to spread religion, I just send out great prophets. I avoid missionaries, actually, for the most part. I'd rather it be, you know what, It's going to take a little longer for my Great Prophet to get there, but I know it's going to get there. It's going to have the full effect from the turn that I had from the outset, and it's going to be more difficult for the AI to try to counter that, so maybe they'll just leave it alone and allow that religion to stay there, and then it can spread to other nearby places. It's wonderful.
You just need 7 holy sites on your capital. Just keep working holy sites for no reason. Just because you can.
Well, if you've got an AI or even a human aggressor or both trying to push their religion on you, then maybe there is a reason to have all those holy sites.
That's true. You wouldn't have trouble buying Inquisitors then.
The Three Moves Ahead podcast, which is co-hosted by Rob Zachney, who's been a guest on episodes 120 and 178 of this show, a little more than a month before this recording, spoke to both John Schaefer and Soren Johnson, the lead designers on Civilization V and Civilization IV, respectively. See, how I actually said John Schaefer before Soren Johnson. Quote, this venerable strategy series turns 25 this year, and John and Soren give their takes on other entries in the series and give some insight into their design decisions for Civ 4 and Civ 5, and as is common on Three Moves Ahead, which is a general strategy gaming podcast, they list the games that are talked about, not necessarily in equal measure, but it lists, it goes Civilization 1, Civilization 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 6, and then, just kidding, LOL. And I'm like, oh, I approve of the troll.
They do mention the phrase Civilization 6.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they do. John Schaefer in particular brings up a would-be Civilization 6.
Yeah.
Now, on SoundCloud, this episode, which is one of the places where you can listen to these podcasts, it's already got more than 13,000 listens. It's just over an hour and a half in length. And in listening to it, there was a lot of overlap of things that we've heard in interviews before, either with John or Soren or other people. Because earlier this month, we looked at a panel which included Soren Johnson, although it didn't have John Schaefer, but it also had Sid Meier and Bruce Shelley talking about Civilization at 25. So when I was listening to it, I was trying to listen for things, either topics that weren't covered before, and therefore we didn't talk about it earlier this year in terms of looking at the Civ series, or topics that were talked about and either taking a different approach to answering it or having a different opinion or a combination of the two. Was there some comment or series of comments in exchange that jumped out in particular?
I like when they talked about carryover production when they were designing that.
Let's say your city produces 3 production a turn.
Okay.
Right? You're building a temple. Temple costs 10. Right? So 3, 6, yeah. 9. Okay, great. I'm going to produce 3, but I only need 1 more. So I really don't need 3 production this turn, right?
Yeah.
So if I really want to optimize my city, what I would do is I go in, rearrange my citizens.
And get like 1 turn with a little extra money and less production.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the thing about Civ. Like, if it's possible, that's how people are going to play. Like,
oh, that sounds miserable.
Was that way for 15 years.
It was that way for 15 years.
I can't fathom why it wasn't changed earlier.
You know, I mean, the community complained about it. Until I had released the game, I'm sure I took the community seriously, but I didn't take them seriously enough until after Civ 3 came out. So, you know, with Civ 4, I was like, I am going to solve all the problems, right? Because we're starting this from scratch. I'm going to solve all the problems.
Yeah, right.
That was his goal.
I credit him for trying, but then it turned into granary whip overflow micromanagement instead.
With what became overflow was the solution. It was that, okay, now you still produce 3, right? You got 9 production, you need 1 more. If you produce 3, what happens is those extra 2, they get automatically applied to whatever you build next.
Civ 4 went back on its word in that regard because they eventually nerfed overflow multiple times, both in terms of the gold you would get from it and then just how much overflow you could get, to the point where, despite the stated goal of making it less micromanagement intensive, ultimately several of the patch changes made it more micromanagement intensive than it ever was in Civ 4 previously. And then they just left it like that.
In other words, it works like you would expect it to work now, finally.
Well, I don't think someone would expect that.
Producing a certain amount per turn.
What you're doing is you're not punishing someone for not paying attention. Right.
I don't think it's so much that you're penalized for not paying attention, but that you're given a bonus for, in fact, paying attention and willing to micro that so that, okay, I'm going to move off the production and go on to gold for this turn because I don't need that much production on this turn in order to be able to finish that particular item that I'm constructing.
I guess. You know, to some degree, I agree with Soren's philosophy in this case, though. You know that's the strongest thing to do, but it's not exactly a deep strategic consideration. It's just, can you be bothered to do this
can you be bothered to check every city to notice that there's the opportunity for this? There's no strategy there. There's not really any trade-offs in that case either. You're just doing mundane micromanagement for the sake of getting a little bit more yield. To me, that's not really in the spirit of a strategy game, nor is it particularly engaging gameplay. I guess some people like their Excel spreadsheets and doing that kind of thing, but there's not much strategy to it. It's always beneficial. You always do it. It's work.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. If you're going to go out of your way to micromanage that, then, okay, you should get something for that time.
Why incentivize that, though?
Was it really worth the time, though? Was it really worth it? It depends.
Why create incentives for mundane tasks in gaming? That's my question. If it's going to be something that's always beneficial to the point where you don't even have to think about it, why? Why build a mechanic that has that kind of incentive built in?
All I can think of is that it might be more useful on higher difficulty levels just because of the AI dirt bonuses, but even that...
Scale the bonuses. Like, clearly the issue is not DD players being capable of winning. Akin in Civ 5 has actually created a mod to make it harder because regular Civ 5 DD is too easy. And you have that kind of, you have those kinds of players anyway. But even for them, there's not that much skill they're using in the executing of these mundane tasks against how they're playing the rest of their game.
I mean, Soren did say, and this is the thing about Civ, if it's possible, that's how people are going to play.
Yeah, that's true.
To me, it's like if people are willing to actually go ahead and do that, if you don't do this, if you don't micromanage in this respect, you're screwed. No, addressing overflow, I mean, it was nice that they did it, but I didn't think it was absolutely necessary to improve gameplay. Because a lot of people and a lot of players, I don't think they're going to notice or they're going to care. And it's not going to matter in the long run.
Yeah, a lot of us just
it probably wasn't
playing.
Priority, because you're right. You can ignore it, and you can still in on even the highest difficulties while ignoring it. Although I still don't like it, because if you get into multiplayer and stuff, like somebody having a 10-turn advantage on you because they were willing to go to that effort, or if it turns into a turn timer thing where only the fastest players can do it, there are some issues there. It's not the biggest issue in any of the games, certainly. Multiplayer working at all has definitely been the bigger issue in Civ 4 and 5 over most of their life cycles. But it's still an issue. It's still useful to correct it. It's like a minor problem as opposed to a serious problem.
Most of your average player types aren't even going to bother with this kind of thing or bother with micromanaging in general. So, you know, for a large chunk of players, okay, that's great. And what does this do for me?
And it makes sense that when Soren says, like, the community complained about it, because that's where you're going to get the congregation of the players who really want to micromanage and notice these things and care about it. Yeah.
That's where I was going next. Ah. That vocal minority.
Oh, Mackie and I are on the same wavelength again. Yes.
Yeah, I don't like the vocal minority thing because it gets abused as an argument a lot.
Oh, now I got a Green Day song in my head. So, next.
I mean, we kind of touched on next, like this, if aging gracefully. And I'm not sure that it's aged gracefully so much as that it's adapted over the years.
Yeah, because we've had, if you just look at Civ 5 alone, we've had expansions since when it originally came out, which is partially why we're still playing it in 2016.
But they've also, in both Civ 4 and 5, been willing to hard shift core mechanics to a degree and completely alter some of your incentives. And tall versus wide was a mistake, but they also implemented a lot of things that were not. And you can make a case for either civics or social policies, but it's worth pointing out that both were very different directions from previous games.
Yeah, you just said with that general government type of thing beforehand.
It's the same thing with limiting ICS in one way or another between the games, too. They changed the methodology, but the way they did that altered gameplay completely. They're willing to make changes like that, or the one unit per hex thing, or implementing hexes.
Yeah, over all of us going, hexes, no, icky.
No, there wasn't too much blowback on the hexes, I think. Maybe in part because of the one unit per thing. overwhelmed,
no doom stacks in the hexes.
That just overwhelmed the hex discussion. Like, people were enough annoyed by or embracing of one unit per hex that the whole, hey, they're hexes now. No one cared. Or very few people cared.
It's like in the beginning before we knew it, the one unit and everybody's like, oh, hexes, what? And I said one unit and everybody's like, what?
But they're willing to do this stuff, so I'm not sure it's really quote-unquote aging here. They're making big changes in both new games and expansions. They're keeping some of the Civ feel there, but, man, it's more like they're switching out limbs on a cyborg or something.
I agree with that. I'm not sure, to be honest, if it was still just vanilla Civ 5 without Gods and Kings and Brave New World, I'm not sure that I would still be playing it, to be honest.
Not in multiplayer, certainly not. Yeah.
That game is really weak. That's why I quit playing it for a while. I was not happy.
That, and it was crash happy in multiplayer.
Well, yeah, that's still a bit of a problem even now, but less so.
I think in that respect, it's kind of saying Civilization 5 Brave New World, I think, is aging gracefully. Civilization 5 is not. Although you could say, was Civilization 5 vanilla ever ever graceful anyway? But, you know, let alone aging.
It never had a time in the sun, really. It was kind of bad, straight up.
But it also begs the question, when you look at earlier Civilization titles, if, for in fact, there had not been a Civilization 5, would Civilization 4 have aged gracefully, or would it have aged differently? Just like if there had only been the original Civ, would we still view the original Civ in the same way as if there hadn't been the successor titles? And first off, I don't think there's really any way that we can answer that, because we know there are successor titles, whether we played them or not, for whatever reason. I think it's when you're talking about aging gracefully, can you pick up an old game, whether it's Civilization or not, and old, air quotes, because yeah, admittedly it's a relative term, just like age is a relative term. Can you install it, and can you have fun for what it is? You're not going to be able to separate your comments of, boy, I really wish, you know, the original Civ had what Civilization 2 had in this respect, or what Civilization 3 had in this respect. But is it something that you can install, and you could go, not even necessarily, quote-unquote, win whatever victory condition is associated with it, but could you have fun playing it? And if you do have fun playing it, however you define that, then I think for you, it has aged gracefully.
I tried playing Civ 1 a few months ago, and I could not have fun playing it again, mainly because I think I was still trying to play with Civ 5 mechanics. Like, I was really confused. Wait, how did the CPU just move two units into one time? Oh, wait.
Yeah, first off, stacks. What?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it might be fun if I could stop thinking of it in terms of Civ 5, but when I tried it, it was not very much fun at all.
Yeah, the Civ playing part of my brain is programmed for 5. It wouldn't be so hard necessarily to go back to, like, 4, but trying to go back further, it's just like, huh?
Well, if you go back further, you start running into stuff like, okay, I want to move all these units at once, but you can't. And you start running afoul of, like, interface stuff that just the conventions that you've become used to in the last 20 years just didn't exist, at least not for Civ back then. And that makes it pretty frustrating to play through, because you have to move every unit individually every turn or ignore boot cycling through them, and neither of those are attractive options. I think Civ 4 has aged gracefully in that regard. It has some pretty significant flaws to its UI, but you can...
But there's a mod for that.
Yeah,
literally.
It's still good enough where you could definitely enjoy it. And it has enough of its own unique mechanics, in contrast to, say, going from 1 to 2, that it can stand on its own.
And I think we talked about this before on the show, that when Civilization V came out, it was the first time that I felt like I could have two different Civ titles installed on my PC and play them both, not simultaneously, but play them both and get enjoyment out of both, because they were different enough that it was, okay, what I've lost from Civilization IV to Civilization V, which at the time was like stability in multiplayer, because multiplayer was a big thing for me, as compared to, say, in Civilization V, maybe the mechanics aren't working as they should be, but I like what I'm seeing. Maybe even if it was just like a visual change, like, ooh, this is nice, or, ooh, but again, I like the idea of playing with one hex, and so we get Carpets of Doom instead of Stacks of Doom. But if you're trying to go back to even Civilization IV or an earlier title, as Phil said, you're thinking, oh, man, I wish I had this. And it's hard to say if you would be thinking, I wish it had this, because you know there's been a subsequent title, and you could be playing a later subsequent title that has that. But if the Civ series had stopped, you might be viewing it more positively in looking back on it as compared to say that, oh, well, it hasn't aged as well because there has been a successor title. Sometimes the aging is not just because of what the game is, but it's also relative to what came before and what came after it, which I think is also what they were getting at on the podcast as well.
One of the games that perhaps is most frustrating for me in this way is Civilization IV. And it's just because Civilization V has the one unit per hex, and I cannot deal with those stacks of doom ever, ever, ever again. Like, I think Civilization IV is a better game in almost every way, or at least it's not a worse game, and it's one of my all-time favorite most played games, but man, that one little change is just like, I can't go back to an older Civilization anymore.
Yeah,
it's just not within my capability.
Aww.
was Sean on that panel, Sean Sands. So then Dr. Frog says, in response on the Three Moves Ahead forums, well, I wonder if maybe Civ 4, as groundbreaking and loved as it is, maybe is really a great game, but is not and never was a very good experience. Which, like, is especially that part about never was, this retroactive thing. I don't want to apply that. But to say that it was not a very good experience, I think that part of what makes a really great game is that it is a good experience because it is supposed to be a game. And there are many other things, games and otherwise, that have demands on our attention. So something can be groundbreaking and introduce a mechanic that you've never seen before. And if it's implemented poorly, then whoop-de-doo. You implemented something just because you say you could. It's not an academic exercise. It's a practical exercise, and games are meant to be played.
I mean, I know at some point we all had our frustrations with it, especially after coming from Civ 3 into Civ 4. It was definitely a better experience. I can't see how it would ever have not been a good experience. Because that's every game. Eventually, after you've played it for so many hours, you see the littler flaws type of things become bigger things.
Yeah.
It's almost like, actually, in the case of Civilization III, that Civilization III was born prematurely.
Oh.
Because it got me to go back to play Civilization II. When Civ IV came out, it was a question of, do I want to stop playing Civilization II and play Civilization III? And there was actually that initial hesitation because of Civ III, not even because of what Civ IV or Civ IV wasn't. It was, I tried to play the next title after Civ II, and I got burned, and I went back to Civ II. So I actually waited until the very first expansion came out for Civilization IV Warlords before I really started paying any attention to what was going on with Civilization IV.
My favorite Civilization game of all time was actually Civilization II, and that's even further away for all the same reasons. You know, once you get to Civilization IV, how can you go back to Civilization II? Once you get to V, how can you go back to IV? A lot of times, it's not that a game wouldn't have aged well had it not just simply been surpassed.
I stayed with Civ II, and Civ IV was out for almost a year before the first expansion pack came out, and that had nothing to do with what people were saying. Civ IV was great. And it was, yeah, but people were saying that too, but paying more attention to the negative things people were paying about Civilization IV than the positive, because it fit my narrative. Well, of course, after Civilization II, the next Civ title is a disappointment. Therefore, I stick with Civ II, specifically Civilization II, Test of Time.
I was going to say to you, even if you'd only waited just like an extra couple of months afterwards, you would have already seen people telling you the things that were different from Civ III, that this is actually better than that. But no, I can see being focused on the negative things when you're kind of expecting negatives.
So I guess in a way it did lower expectations, so maybe I appreciated Civilization V more than I should have. What?
No.
But on the point of one hex per tile, going back to the episode 248 of the podcast, of specifically Three Moves Ahead, and Phil mentioned that Civ 6 came up on the podcast, John Schaefer said,
if I were making another Civ game, I definitely wouldn't do 1 unit per tile again, and I am looking forward to seeing the response once the Civ 6 and whatever it approach it takes gets announced.
Wow. Really? He wouldn't take 1 unit per tile again?
Yeah. I would like to also see not 1 unit per tile. There's some issues with it, to be sure. I don't want to go back to pure Stacks of Doom. Civ 2, I feel, had the right idea in having a penalty possible for stacking too many units on one tile. I don't know if that was the best solution, but the idea that you can do it but it's disincentivized is a good one, because then you have to weigh the usefulness of putting another unit on that tile, but it makes just handling all of your units much less onerous. That's a serious barrier. Like, a lot of what made Civ fun in some of the previous games was the ability to just handle sprawling empires, but when you have to move every single unit you own individually, that becomes a much larger task, but it also forces the game's scaling to revolve around it. And so you are more limited in terms of the scale you can operate the game. Making the decision to go 1 unit per hex pervades how other things in the game are implemented throughout, including the number of cities you can realistically expect and more. So a very strong case could be made for allowing stacking to some degree and penalizing it. And I think that's the direction Civ 6 should go, and I would be surprised, given how 4 and 5 progressed, if that isn't the direction they go ultimately.
As an example of Civilization 4, the extreme when it comes to having, quote-unquote, essentially as many units as you want, versus in Civilization 5, where it's one extreme or the other. The one hex per tile, I think a lot of it was, in a way, a knee-jerk reaction to Civilization IV and earlier Civ titles of, once again, it's the Stack of Doom, once again, it's the Stack of Doom. And as far as a penalty for certain numbers on a stack, whether we're talking about squares or hexes, whatever, triangles, hexagons, whatever, that as long as that limit scales, game speed, map size, era, whatever, as long as it's not, okay, from the beginning of the game to the end of the game, you cannot have a stack that's more than 5. Like, as long as there's, like, a relative scale there, you know, and it works well within whatever mechanics are included, you know, whether you borrow from Civilization 5 or not, Civilization 4 or not, brand new, then that would make sense to me, too.
4 hasn't test cases. It wasn't a pure extreme. In the early game, it was, because there's no siege, so there's no collateral damage. So a larger stack was strictly better. If you got into the era of nukes and did that, I would say that you were a very poor player if you stacked all your units on one tile knowing your opponent had nukes, because you're just asking to lose everything you have in an instant. Well, so there's two extremes on that thing, but in between that you had collateral initiative with siege, which had varying degrees of quality depending on your era. Catapults were some threat there, but not huge. Once you got the cannons and beyond, being the one to defend as a large stack was a serious disadvantage, to the point where you might even prefer attacking somebody on a hill if you could get enough collateral initiative on them if they were, they were putting themselves there. You didn't want to perma mega stack against human players in that environment any longer. So there was some downside to it, but it took a while to manifest in the game, and I would argue that it wasn't strong enough of a disincentive for most of the time, because you needed really big numbers before it started becoming problematic defending against siege, because it would damage all your units.
I like the one unit per tile constraints much more than the Stacks of Doom for strategic reasons. But I think, at least from the single-player perspective, the biggest problem with one unit per tile was the AI's ineffectiveness in using in tactics in particular.
Don't even get us started on the tactic. It's so bad. Embark next to the archer. Come on.
Well, how do stacks compensate for mountain ranges? If you a stack of 10 units, like, what's the point of a mountain choke point?
Well, you're going to try to bust through another stack sitting on the choke point with defensive bonuses. It's not actually that easy to do, even in Civ 4. Like, if someone put a fort on a defensive terrain and that was a choke, you would use a ton of resources trying to bash through it.
Well, it just kind of defeats the concept of a choke, though. Like, yeah, you could have 10 units, and they could have 10 units, but you're not supposed to build a fight with that many in a mountain passage.
You're not going to win if you do it. And so far, you need such a huge advantage. You're not going to win that way.
On the number of turns that could be quote-unquote correct in the game?
It's probably not 500.
No, I don't think so. The biggest thing, though, is you think about the 4X game, explore, expand, exploit, exterminate. The first half of Civ contains a lot of exploration, a lot of expansion, a lot of exploitation, and, you know, a certain amount of extermination. By the time you get to the late game, you're down to extermination, because there's nothing to explore, you've covered the map in cities, everything's built
and
up.
Even exploiting is pretty dull, because it's like, oh, I guess I'll build the +5 version of the +3 building from a generation ago.
Right, yeah. So the whole appeal of the game, of the genre, is basically bleeding out by the mid-game, and then there's just what's left at the end. Yeah. Like, I think it's an intractable problem in a way.
I mean, grinding your enemies into dust is never that bad, right? You know, I mean, it's still like, well, this is what we'll do. I'll wipe them out. But, like, is this the best way to make a strategy game like this, right? Like,
it's also something where, you know, you do that once, and you're like, okay, it's fun. And then you have 7 other opponents, and you're like, all right, well, here we go. Do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again. And it doesn't... Nothing's really changing. You're usually just steamrolling over.
Yeah. For a lot of people, I think basically Civ, the way the level they played at, Civ basically becomes kind of like the RPG where you're overleveled at the end. Like, basically you get to God mode at the end. Like, you know, I play at a level so that I'm at tanks when everyone else is at knights, right? And then that's just the question. I just have to roll through all their cities, right? But one way or another, like, it's, yeah, I mean, that's tedious.
And I've seen deity players give you, like, an exact turn time. They're going to win a culture victory more than 50 turns before it happens. You know that outcome at that stage. Outright, you know it. But you still have to go through the motions to get it. And, yeah, that does suggest to me that the tuning could be better somehow. But I don't know that they've said anything concrete in terms of what a better model would look like. but certainly having somewhere between half to a third of the game for the end game, just being hitting end turn and waiting for the interface to let you execute what's left of it until you get the win condition isn't ideal.
Yeah, no, neither Soren or John or host Rob Zagney suggested a suggested next step in order to address this. Not in so much Gods and Kings, but Brave New World with the ideology system. Rather than it just being about extermination, and if not the mid, then certainly the latter part of the game, they added a bit more of the exploitation aspect of the 4X. But A, exploration and expansion are still missing, and B, it doesn't get to the fundamental point of what you're saying, Phil. We already know, or reasonably know, what is going to happen. Who is going to win? Maybe it's going to change the variable of, you know, I don't know if it's going to be turn 260 that I'm going to win. It might be 265 or 270. So it added a little bit of flavor in there, but it really didn't change either anything you're doing in the mid to late game, or really anything that you were doing in the first half of the game either.
Yeah. That's the problem, isn't it? Like, yeah, at some point, the number of meaningful decisions you make per turn just go down because it stops mattering.
Like, maybe the ideology gives you, oh, you have to take this detour. Oh, fine, but I'm still going to get to my end destination. I mean, there are always exceptions, but more often than not, it's just kind of like, oh, you adopted a different ideology than I have? Well, either I don't have to worry about that because my culture output is greater, or guess what? Back to extermination, I'm just going to go and squish you. And then your tourism becomes my tourism, and there's nothing you can do about it. Related to that, springboarding off of the 4Xs, specifically on expansion.
The penalties for expansion in Civ 4 could be quite harsh. Like, you could build a city, and then minus 10 maintenance, yeah. And oh my.
Yeah.
This is bad.
it's funny because in many ways it's worse than corruption. Right? Like, corruption just
more punishing.
It just means your cities will be making less stuff, right? But like in Civ 4, you can put yourself actually in a hole.
And I'm like, ooh.
If you're talking about absolute penalties, yes, because corruption and waste in previous Civ mechanics could render one individual city useless. But that's about the extent of it. You would still have a core of cities that functioned well, and you were never really going to make yourself much worse off for having a new city. If you were playing the higher difficulty levels in Civ 4 and you built too many cities, you could get yourself into a situation where you couldn't really afford military units and you couldn't tech because you couldn't afford to put your slider on that. And you're kind of stuck. If you tried to build a worker, they'd go out and strike. So you'd have to like intentionally lose cities and go back, and you would lose a frick ton of time in the process. I would say that that's much harsher of a consequence for overexpanding compared to corruption. So if you mean in terms of the, not in terms of like gameplay preference, but just in terms of the penalties involved, no question. None of the other anti-expansion mechanics were as harsh as Civ 4 maintenance potentially was, because you could lose the game on it.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing like bankrupting yourself.
Yeah.
What? Where did my unit go? Disbanded. Uh-oh. Can I get a loan? No. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Game over. Reload. Next game.
Different things are connecting up in different ways instead of just build more city. Yes, no. Gold, yes, no. You know, it's one axis of decision-making. So I think if you kind of mix things way up and did something like that, where it's multiple different competing, overlapping trade-offs, then it could be made something really interesting. But I think as it stands right now, it's kind of a simpler system. It's just, I don't know, it still kind of gives me a bad taste in my mouth, Civ 5 included.
And then lastly, I pulled up from episode 248 of Three Moves Ahead, again looking at 25 years since the original Civilization for the PC was released. The influence on Civ. Rob Zachney says,
has Civ's influence been 100% positive on grand strategy gaming as a whole?
Guess what, Rob? The answer to that is no, because you said 100% positive. It's like saying, has Civ's influence been absolutely negative on grand strategy gaming as a whole? No. But now, neither Soren nor John took that quite so literally, focused on the percentage.
I would say absolutely, because when Civ 5 came out, how many 4X games were being released? Two? I don't know.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But things have changed dramatically. Now it's like, oh my goodness, there's so many 4X games coming out. And that is objectively a better thing. It means you're going to get more games, you're going to get more people in there playing, more people trying new things. I think that's just objectively good. Certainly some downsides to that, but I would say absolutely yes.
I would say to John, more isn't necessarily better, but because there are more titles coming out, more people are trying different things, then in addition to Civ having an influence on those titles can have an influence on Civ, which gives gamers more choices, and that, objectively, yes, is better. Maybe even as compared to when we started the show almost 10 years ago, even the kind of the back of my mind, I was like, man, is turn-based strategy effectively go away? Is it, quote-unquote, just going to be Civ, or will there in fact be any more Civ if there's nothing else other than Civ, like Civ equals turn-based strategy gaming? Now, in 2016, I don't think that's true. Turn-based strategy gaming does not equal Civ. But certainly, you can't talk about turn-based strategy gaming without talking about Civ. That's fine, but as long as it's not the be-all and end-all of the discussion, that's healthy. That's a good thing.
I guess it's in a sense how you can't really talk about real-time strategy without mentioning StarCraft. It's like the founder of not the founder of the genre, necessarily, but...
Not even from Blizzard.
Yeah.
Should be the propagator.
Yeah, and most influential in the past decade.
In the past decade, yes. I'm not sure it's actually more influential than Warcraft 2 was if you stretch back to the 90s. Although, I don't know, because StarCraft kind of built on Warcraft 2.
I think you can call it the flagship of the genre.
Yeah.
There you go.
At this stage, there's no question it
is. And you could say the same of Civ for turn-based strategy.
Yeah. These days you can.
You know, if you think about it, half the time if you go to try and explain a different turn-based game, you start up, well, it's like Civ, but...
Yeah.
And then perhaps in conclusion, in the comments on idlethumbs.net, Cornchip, I really enjoyed this episode. I can't think of two games besides Civilization 4 and 5 that would cause such interesting discussion about what was changed or not changed as the series progressed. The contrast between the perfect and most successful Civ gave me a lot to think about. But then Barrowmeat said, good stuff. Feel like this kind of puts a cap on all the various Civ discussions over the past years. No. There is no such thing as a cap on Civ discussion. Wrong, 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 wrong.
You're limited to roughly 24 hours a day. You can't go over that, unless you use editing to go at a faster speed.
Well, when you have fallback, it could be 25 hours that day.
That's true. Oh, I said roughly, after all.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
All right, Polycast number 254. We have Makula.
many times mispronounced, but still all we need.
I like it pronounced that way, though. And then we have Dan.
Rockin' on.
We have Mr. Ray.
Peace out.
And we have Phil.
You can have as much of me per tile as you want.
Can we have a negative value?
Zero Phil in my tiles, please.
Negative Phil per tile.
Let's cue Olivia Newton-John. Wait, no, let's not do that. Next topic.
Best segue ever, yes, next topic. That's you, Mackie. Please, Mackie.
I have to scroll backwards to look at it.
You have to let it linger. Do you have to? Do you have to?
Oh, and then, Chris, don't forget to also reintroduce yourself.
Just say your username.
Yeah.
Chris, or have yourself on mute or something. That's
oh, what? my dog was distracting me.
Just say your username as well.
Arvius.
Oh, are you not Anslion anymore?
Either or.
Okay, so I get you to say Anslion then?
Yeah, either or.
Just say it. know, because sometimes you get this either Phil and Madgen go off on a thing or Dan and Phil go off on a thing. I was like, I'm just going to sit here and let them, yeah.
No way. You should come in on it, too.
Well, sometimes I don't have a strong enough of opinion or something to really argue it. So
it would be like a three-way, then. Three-way discussion.
Really, Phil?
A three-way discussion.
I was thinking it.
Recording April 30th, 2016. Three Moves Ahead clips, courtesy Three Moves Ahead. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.